Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lin, Susan Shand, and Anna Mateo. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lin.
By now, most people have heard of Bitcoin. Bitcoin is a virtual currency that has had a huge rise in value during 2017. Bitcoin, however, is just one of many cryptocurrencies. A cryptocurrency is a kind of money that does not exist in the form of bills or coins. It is not overseen by banks or supported by governments. It is exchanged digitally between buyers and sellers using encryption for security. Amounts of cryptocurrency are created through a method called mining by developers. Mining involves users of the system lending computer power to record the exact same transactions during a certain block of time. This activity is called a blockchain. A blockchain is a global record of how cryptocurrencies are exchanged. Because cryptocurrencies and blockchains are technically complex, they can be difficult to understand. This has prevented many people from using Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies. One company is trying to change people's opinions with its new online game, CryptoKitties. The game lets people use blockchain technology to buy, trade, and breed virtual cats. Axiom Zen is the company behind CryptoKitties. It says the game operates on a blockchain that uses the cryptocurrency Ethereum, which is sometimes also called Ether. People use Ethereum to buy CryptoKitties. The game requires users to buy Ethereum from an exchange site such as Coinbase and then transfer amounts into a crypto wallet system called MetaMask. Once this is completed, people can log on to the CryptoKitties site and play the game. The company says each kitty is unique, has a name, and is represented by a number. A new one is created every 15 minutes. Creators of the game say one reason CryptoKitties are highly collectible is because each has its own set of genes, just like people. When players breed kitties, the newborns carry on genetic traits of the parents. Elsa Wilk is the marketing director for Axiom Zen. She says the worldwide response has been huge since the launch of CryptoKitties. One of the company's goals has been to educate people who know very little about cryptocurrencies. But the game is not only about education and fun. People can also make a lot of money playing it. For example, some CryptoKitties are highly collectible and sought after. Just days after the November 28th launch, people had reportedly spent more than $2 million on the virtual kittens. A third-party site that follows sales says several crypto kitties sold for amounts equivalent to more than $100,000. The site noted that as of December 29th, the most valuable crypto kitty was worth more than $191,000. Elsa Wilk agrees that money can be made from crypto kitties. But she warns people to be careful about how much they put into any cryptocurrency. She added that it does not cost a lot to try the game.
With CryptoKitties, we went out of our way to price the kitties in such a way that anybody can buy one. So if you have $10 and an Ethereum account, you can buy a CryptoKitty.
So what is next for Axiom Zen after the success of CryptoKitties?
We are working on our 2018 roadmap, and we've had a number of requests for battling cats or crypto doggies or crypto dinosaurs. We haven't, I would say, finalized our plans around that yet, but I can tell you that we are considering a number of options, and this is definitely not the last you've heard of us.
I'm Brian Lynn.
China has made the sale of ivory in the country illegal. Conservationists have welcomed the decision. They say any legal ivory trade in the world hurts efforts to stop the killing of elephants. Max Graham is the chief executive of the group Space for Giants, which works to protect elephants. He said, there's a new conservation superpower in the world that is taking its responsibilities seriously. He said that the ban on the ivory trade will support a larger struggle against all kinds of illegal trade in wildlife. The traditional use of wildlife parts in Asia, and especially in China, he said, has been responsible for the loss of rare species around the world. China announced the ban at the end of 2016. The measure went into effect in December 2017. Conservationists say that stopping the illegal killing of elephants for their ivory tusks is important, but so is managing their living areas. They urge African governments to do more to reduce threats to wildlife. I'm Susan Shand.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Which is more popular, coffee or tea? If you are on Team Coffee, your team may be ahead. The well-known U.S. coffee shop, Starbucks, just opened its largest store in the land of tea, China. The Shanghai Starbucks is 2,700 square meters and employs more than 400 people. But now for the health question. Is coffee good for us? There have been many studies on the health benefits of coffee. Recently, researchers at the University of Southampton's Faculty of Medicine in Great Britain looked at results from 201 observational coffee studies and 17 clinical trials of coffee. With this umbrella review, researchers wanted to find a clear answer on whether coffee is good for us or not. They discovered that coffee drinkers had a lower risk of heart and liver disease and some cancers. Coffee drinkers also had a lower risk of dying from stroke. However, their findings are uncertain. The researchers could not prove coffee was the cause of these lowered risks. One of the researchers of this umbrella review is Robin Poole. Poole's team notes that their umbrella review included many observational data. Therefore, they could not prove any cause and effect relationship. The National Institutes of Health in the U.S. define an observational uncontrolled study as a study where researchers simply watch what happens to a series of people in one group. There is no control group. Still, researchers found that the benefits of moderate coffee drinking seem to outweigh the risks. Their report says that drinking coffee was more often associated with benefit than harm. Poole calls these findings headline benefits.
There are some headline benefits, such as a lower risk of dying from any cause, a lower risk of dying from heart disease and stroke, and a lower risk of developing heart disease in the first place. And for those outcomes, the maximum benefit was around 3 to 4 cups of coffee per day.
Poole means that if people read only the headline, they may think that the results are simply positive. But he warns that the coffee story is much more complicated. He advises people to not drink more than 4 cups a day. And not everyone should drink so much coffee. Researchers found that too much coffee during pregnancy can be dangerous. People, especially women whose bones break easily, should limit how much coffee they drink. People with abnormal heartbeat patterns are advised to drink decaffeinated coffee. In addition, the scientists point out that the research was only about coffee. Yet many coffee drinkers don't just drink coffee. They put sugar into it. They add milk or cream. They may have a baked treat on the side. Researcher Robin Poole warns that to get the full health benefits of coffee, keep it simple. Drinking it black is the healthiest. And skip the pastries.
It's not about the sugar and the syrups and the biscuits, cakes and pastries. And we'd urge people who are already drinking moderate amounts of coffee, about 3 or 4 cups per day mark, to enjoy it, but try and make it as healthy as possible, because standard health messages still apply to those other things.
The researchers found that the greatest benefit to drinking coffee seemed to be in fighting liver diseases. Based on that finding, they are planning a clinical test using coffee as a treatment for cirrhosis, a serious liver disease. But the final takeaway is the same as before. If you drink coffee, keep it simple and don't eat the pastries or other baked treats that often come with a cup of coffee. And if you're not a coffee drinker, you don't need to start drinking coffee to be healthier. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Anna Mateo.
from VOA Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. We have been talking about the War of 1812 between the United States and Britain. In the summer of 1814, the two countries opened peace talks at Ghent in Belgium. But Britain was in no hurry to agree on a peace treaty. This week, we tell the story of how the war ended. British forces were planning several campaigns in the United States in the autumn and winter of 1814. Successful military campaigns could force the United States to accept the kind of treaty Britain wanted. British representatives to the talks demanded that the United States give control of its Northwest Territory to the Indians. They also asked that the United States give part of the state of Maine to Canada and make other changes in the border. The Americans made equally tough demands. The United States wanted payment for damages suffered during the war. It also wanted the British to stop seizing American sailors for the British Navy. And the United States wanted all of Canada. The British representatives said they could not even discuss the question of stopping impressment by Americans into the British Navy, and the Americans would surrender none of their territory. Most of America's representatives had little hope the talks would succeed, but then Britain received word that its military campaigns had failed at Baltimore and Plattsburgh. After that, the British representatives became easier to negotiate with. They dropped their demands for American territory. The Americans then dropped their demands for Canadian territory. The issues that had led to the war no longer existed. Britain's war with France had caused the British and French to interfere with neutral American trade. And Britain had needed men for its navy. Now the war with France was over. No longer was there any reason to interfere with the trade of any nation. And no longer was there any need to seize Americans for service in the British Navy. On December 24th, the day before Christmas in 1814, the United States and Britain signed a simple treaty. Each side agreed to stop fighting. They also agreed to settle all their differences at future negotiations. The war had ended, but one more battle was to be fought before news of the peace treaty reached the United States. During the autumn of 1814, British soldiers at Jamaica began preparing for an attack against New Orleans, a city at the mouth of the Mississippi River. Late in November, this force of about 7,500 men sailed from Jamaica to New Orleans. The British soldiers were commanded by General Edward Pakenham. The general did not take his men directly to the mouth of the Mississippi River. Instead, they sailed across a lake east of the city. Early during the afternoon of December 23rd, General Andrew Jackson, the commander of American forces at New Orleans, learned that the British force was near. General Jackson was a good soldier and a great leader. He fought in the Revolutionary War, then studied law. He moved west to Nashville, Tennessee. The general also served in both houses of the United States Congress. When war broke out in 1812, he was elected general of a group of volunteer soldiers from Tennessee. Jackson was a rough man. His soldiers feared and respected him. They called him Old Hickory because he seemed as tough as hickory wood. Jackson was given responsibility for defending the coast along the Gulf of Mexico. Earlier in the year, he had attacked Pensacola in Florida and forced out several hundred British Marines. Jackson believed the British would attack Mobile before attacking New Orleans. He left part of his forces at Mobile and took the others to the mouth of the Mississippi. Jackson was a sick man when he got to New Orleans, and what he found made him feel no better. Little had been done to prepare for the expected British attack. Jackson declared martial law and began building the city's defenses. Most of the work on the defenses had been completed when Jackson got word that the British were only a few kilometers from New Orleans. "Gentlemen," Jackson told his officers, "the British are below. We must fight them tonight." The British soldiers rested. They believed it would be easy to capture the city the next day. But Jackson rushed up guns and men and attacked the British by surprise just after dark. Then the Americans retreated to a place about 8 kilometers south of the city. Jackson had chosen this place carefully. On the right was the Mississippi River. On the left was the mud and water of a swamp that could not easily be crossed. In front of the American soldiers was an open field. For 2 weeks, the British soldiers waited. They tested the American defenses at several places, but found no weaknesses. Every day, Jackson had his men improve their positions. At night, small groups of Jackson's soldiers would slip across the field and silently attack British soldiers guarding the other side. Finally, on January 8th, the British attacked. They expected the Americans to flee in the face of their strong attack, but the Americans stood firm. Jackson's artillery fired into the enemy. When the British got as close as 150 meters, the Americans began to fire their rifles. The rain of bullets and shells was deadly. General Pakenham was wounded twice and then killed by a shell that exploded near him. Only one British soldier reached the top of the American defenses. The British finally retreated. They left behind more than 2,000 dead and wounded. 500 other British soldiers had been captured. 13 Americans were killed. It was a great victory for the United States, but one that was not necessary. The war had ended by treaty 2 weeks earlier. Historian Alan Taylor says the peace treaty saved the United States from a very grim situation.
The United States government was bankrupt. It had lost its credit, and it could not raise enough in taxes for the war effort. And most creditors were refusing to lend any more money to the United States. And so it was very unclear how the Americans would conduct another campaign in 1815. because it looked like they wouldn't have the money for it.
The Senate acted quickly to approve the treaty. On February 17, 1815, President Madison declared the war officially ended. It had lasted 2 years and 8 months and united the American people. On the 4th of July in 1815, the nation celebrated its 39th anniversary of independence. In Washington, the man who wrote the Star-Spangled Banner, Francis Scott Key, spoke at the celebrations. Historian Alan Taylor says many people call the War of 1812 America's second war for independence, but he calls it America's first civil war. He says the country had been divided throughout the war, but things changed after Andrew Jackson's victory at New Orleans.
And so Americans then concluded that the war had really been a glorious occasion that had defended national honor and proved the merit of their Republican institutions. And they were so relieved by all of this that they decided to celebrate the war in their memories.
Albert Gallatin, Madison's Treasury Secretary and one of the negotiators at Ghent, said people felt more American after the war. They feel and act more like a nation. Alan Taylor says the War of 1812 was very difficult for the United States, yet Americans remember it as a feel-good war. At the same time, he says, the War of 1812 also united Canadians.
Despite all of their divisions during the war, they felt so relieved that they had fended off American invasion that they remembered the war as a glorious victory over the more powerful United States.
As a result of the war, Alan Taylor says both Americans and Canadians felt a greater sense of nationalism. And because of that, the two nations could relate more peacefully. Each believed it could survive without having to defeat the other.
And today, Canada and the United States are each other's primary trade and security partner in the world.
But not everyone benefited from the end of the war. The opposition Federalist Party found itself greatly embarrassed by the peace. Its leaders had long denounced the war and said Britain could not be defeated. Many of the Federalists had traded with the enemy. Some had worked with the British against their own country. They had even threatened to break up the Union. Once the war was over, the Federalist Party lost its supporters. And then the party itself soon disappeared, even in the New England states, its base of support. The end of the Federalist Party changed politics in the United States. The changes started as early as the next presidential election in 1816. James Madison continued the tradition begun by George Washington and Thomas Jefferson of serving only 8 years as president. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.